So let me give you briefly some background on my request that led to our conversation. I had written about General Berger's guidance back in 2019 when he issued it. I was struck by it, wrote a column for the Post saying how bold I thought he was being and facing up to some basic problems. I had a long talk with General Berger in California 2 weeks ago at the Reagan National Defense Forum. It was an interview, but I really focused on what's happened in the 2 years since your guidance to bring to fruition the ideas that you laid out there. We had a detailed discussion from his standpoint, but he said, to report this out, you really ought to talk to folks at the Warfighting Lab. And also he recommended that I talk to the commander of the 2nd Marine Division, which I'm going to do tomorrow. So that's how I come to be knocking on your door. I sent some examples of the kinds of questions I'm interested in, but I really want to just kind of listen to you. If you assume you understand the basic question I'm asking, how is the Marine Corps different moving forward? What are you not going to do in terms of procurement, missions, doctrine, et cetera?
Yeah, no, thanks very much for that. And I'm happy to, you know, so Smash, sorry, he goes by Smash. He's one of those pilots. Eric Austin here next to me and I will work kind of in close tandem together on this. You know, the Warfighting Lab, you know, we kind of describe ourselves as sort of the headlights for the Marine Corps, you know, concepts, and then turning those concepts, starting to further develop them through war games and live force experimentation with our Marine forces out there, and also in the science and technology portfolio. So not just the organizational design, but the capability investments. And then we work closely with Eric here, who owns the requirements side of things. So really, he kind of owns the checkbook, and he's the guy that for all our great ideas at the Warfighting Lab, he's the guy that's got to sort of balance them within the Marine Corps' total obligation authority, and against, you know, sort of our force structure requirements. But he also looks at the second and third order effects of proposed changes on, you know, what you're probably familiar with is .MILPF, so you know, doctrine, the organization, training, all those sorts of things, to make sure that we're making informed decisions. But so the commandant was, you know, we would certainly concur with you, and I've been here since the beginning with General Berger on this journey, or at least in my current job, since he started this. And, you know, I think he laid out a fairly compelling vision. And then the challenge to us was, you know, how to take that and start to turn spin into torque and make do the analysis and make the organizational design and capability investment decisions that were required in order to sort of operationalize his vision. You know, the commandant, there were a few kind of high-profile, I think, impactful things that he sort of directed up front. And I think that, you know, there's a tangible value in those, but also certainly a messaging component to the force that, you know, for General Berger to say, hey, look, I'm serious here, and we're going to blood some sacred cows, so to speak, was, I think, you know, the way Chris Brose or somebody like that put it once. So the commandant directed some early divestments. In things like, you know, heavy armor, we got rid of tanks, heavy bridges, military, you know, a lot of our military police capacity, a lot of our cannon artillery, just due to the mobility challenges of towed cannon artillery and the range limitations, you know, in the context of pure competition, but also some of our structure. So, you know, some of our infantry battalions and aviation capacity early on. And what that was designed to do was create, you know, a pot of money, basically. So trying to be, you know, take the responsible course of action in what was expected to be a tough budget environment to try to create savings internally to fund modernization. So some of those decisions were made early on, but then a lot of it were problems to be solved that he turned over to us. You know, so one of the things we did early on was kind of try to diversify the tools of analysis that we rely upon and develop them a bit more. So, for instance, you know, wargaming is a tool that we use to, you know, to kind of wring out proposed concepts and organizational design and capability investment decisions, kind of test their value in a free play environment. And that used to be done sort of in a tabletop environment, very analog. So we've started to modernize our capabilities there with some modeling and simulation, commercial gaming tools that allow us to do a better job of modeling sensors and shooters and things like that at a classified level, and to derive, data as it relates to capability, the performance of given organizations and capabilities, to iterate more rapidly and understand the relationships between variables, et cetera. So we invested in that. Mm-hmm. Simulation, studies and analysis, and so just tried to make sure we have a good, diverse analytic framework for the decisions that we're making. We like to say that the journey we're on is concept driven and threat informed. So the General Berger sort of laid out the vision, and then on us was to kind of take that and turn it into operational concepts of how we believe that we will fight within the context of the joint force and the coalition and the naval service going forward. So, and then threat informed. So we've also tried to expand our capabilities and the relationships with organizations that can help us make sure that we're testing what we're trying to do against threat models. So, testing them against an active enemy, somebody that can effectively replicate our future potential adversaries. So the concepts that, and please, if stop me at any time if I'm, going down the wrong path. But the concepts that we've put out over the last, couple of years that have helped to provide refined direction to where we're trying to go with the force is, so one came out actually in 2019, but it's the concept that most closely aligns with General Berger's vision is called Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations. And it's a naval concept signed by the CNO and the Commandant. But a concept is really a hypothesis, right? And so we took this Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations concept, and then we further developed it and published what we call a tentative manual for Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations, or EABO.
So let me stop you there, General. Yeah. For that and for each of the new concepts, give me just a little bit of explanation. Tell me, Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations, what does that mean to the layman?
Okay, so it's a concept for it basically describes a method for the Marine Corps to operate in a contested littoral environment, so in maritime terrain, in which the Marine Corps would employ relatively small, mobile, low signature, and easy to sustain and maintain units of forces who would establish temporary operating locations from which to project power or provide capabilities. So an example would be to put, long-range fires capability on a piece of key terrain that could contribute to sea denial against an adversary, or perhaps a forward arming and refueling point that could help extend the range of aircraft, either Navy or Marine or joint force aircraft, and that these would be relatively small and mobile. So in that, they would be able to persist in a contested environment by being hard to target.
That makes sense? And just, it does. So as I read back on General Berger's guidance and read a little bit into the literature about vulnerabilities of existing Marine Corps missions, bases, et cetera, the argument was that they just would be too vulnerable to the kinds of precision targeted area denial and other missile capabilities that the PRC in particular has. Why wouldn't that also be true with these smaller units? I mean, heaven knows you can target small things as easily as you can big ones. It just takes more missiles.
Yeah, I guess we would say that we think it's actually fairly difficult to target the small things, and there are a lot of things we can do to make it even more difficult. So even, you know, an adversary like China, they've got limited inventories of, you know, the long-range precision, you know, really highest tech weapons. And so they're going to be mm-hmm. all about what they spend those on. And so if you take a unit that's relatively small, and then we're, you know, investing both in training and capabilities that help that unit to be, you know, hard to find. And then you complement that with moving, you know, regularly. Then we think that the signature can be managed in a way that it makes it really it certainly expensive to an adversary in terms of the amount of, you know, sensors they would have to dedicate to trying to find you. And then, you know, their ability to then kind of consummate a kill chain to be able to actually, you know, find you and then, you know, put all the pieces together that it takes in order to put, you know, sort of a head on target would be expensive, you know, in time and in capabilities and challenging. And so we think that there's value to that operating concept. And I think broadly, you know, part of the proposition, David, is that, like, when we talk about a future operating environment in which we fundamentally believe as a nation that we will not fight alone, and that that allies and partners are essential and will be essential to any future fight against any adversary, then you can't mail that in, you know, from a couple thousand miles away. You've got to have standoff capabilities, but it's absolutely essential to have stand-in forces as well, that operating on a day-to-day basis alongside allies and partners, you know, not just to ensure their support and interoperability, but to make sure that you have the kind of familiarity with the operating environment and the ability to kind of set the conditions for success if things escalate. You know, that's not something you can just turn on, you know, from a cold start if things do escalate. So operating persistently, you know, in that terrain forward, complemented by standoff capabilities, there's a synergy there that we think is really important. And then, you know, I think overall, we also think that it's deterrent, right? That, you know, it is particularly, you know, in an environment that's increasingly characterized by gray zone competition, in which it's not just a matter of, you know, high-end conflict or a lack of violence, but, you know, forces postured forward operating alongside allies and partners with relevant capabilities that can persist are inherently, you know, not just combat credible, but deterrent in nature.
So let me just back up. So the first concept, well articulated by you, as we go through it, is this idea of the expeditionary advanced base operations, which are small, mobile, hard to find, hard to target. I get that. Then a second concept that you referenced, but if this is the right time to talk about it, is stand-in forces.
Sure.
General Berger recently published a paper about it. We talked about it in Simi Valley, but if that's a second concept that you've been thinking through, your readout on what stand-in forces mean would be useful for me.
Okay. So the two concepts are complementary, and I would say that stand-in forces, where expeditionary advanced base operations describes sort of a, you know, a specific operating concept, you know, stand-in forces, I think, is broader in terms of describing kind of the character of Marine forces forward, and makes the case for the value proposition of that stand-in force relative to, you know, to standoff capabilities. I think one of the most important things about stand-in forces is that, you know, it is, and really a lot of what I just talked about is, you know, kind of speaks to this concept. But I think, you know, one of the things is there's a certain positional advantage that forces have by being, you know, forward in close to the adversary, you know, on key terrain, and that, you know, that these forces will have lethal capabilities. But what they will also contribute to, and this is sort of essential to not only to deterrence, but to setting the conditions for success if things escalate, is, you know, sort of in layman's terms, what they will be able to do is, you know, and we're investing in capabilities that will help them to sense and make sense of the operational environment and the adversary, and then at the same time deny the adversary the ability to do the same. And that not only provides benefit to the stand-in forces and the allies and partners that they're operating alongside, but it also buys, you know, flexibility and maneuver space for either the naval or the joint force, you know, to gain access at a time and place of their choosing. So I think that's probably the main thing that I would add.
Yeah, just to clarify what that might mean, I understand your discussion of denying, giving you the ability to make sense of the operational environment and deny the adversary the ability to do the same as being a ISR sensor issue and an EW issue in the second instance.
Yeah, I mean, that's Smash, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was just going to say, David, Eric Austin here, it's probably that and more, right? Some of it just, it depends on how you're going to sense, and there's a myriad ways, and one of the things that has complicated our life is we're operating in so many domains. So how do we complement the joint force and take advantage of our position and the opportunities that present them to collect in different domains to sense? I guess I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. But certainly there are exquisite capabilities tied to, the electromagnetic spectrum operations, that are very relevant, as are space, you know, cyber and other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll absolutely our fundamental component of lethality that you know, Marines will always bring to a fight, but expanding our kit and our sort of contributions in non-kinetic effects is also something that we're certainly putting a lot of effort into.
So when General Berg and I were talking about his paper on stand-in forces, and he said, you know, basically, so what do you think? And impressive conceptually, but I said I had the same worries about it, that that these forces would be vulnerable in precisely the same way that the traditional Marine forces were vulnerable to an adversary with the ability to precision target, to move early in a campaign to deny our forces, our interoperability with partner forces, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, that was my really quick reaction to stand-in forces, with some of the same worries that I have about vulnerability of standoff forces. Am I nuts? Is that a stupid response? And if I'm wrong, tell me why.
Yeah, no. I mean, so you're not alone in expressing concern about, you know, sort of, hey, the survivability of those forces. And, you know, I think, you know, to the earlier part of the conversation, I think there are a lot of things that we can do, we believe, to, you know, to manage risk there and to keep those forces, sustainable and able to persist in that environment. Does it mean it's without risk? Of course not. But to the point about, you know, kind of moving first, I mean, that is a big part of why we think the stand-in force concept is essential, is that, you know, based on, you know, time distance, look, I mean, we know we're going to be, you know, if you believe that we're not going to get as much indications and warnings as we would like of an adversary intention to escalate, and if you believe that we're going to be contested in all domains in any attempt to project power from distance, you know, starting back at home station, mm-hmm. in San Diego or Long Beach or wherever, you know, then that's a big part of what leads us to this stand-in force concept. I mean, you know, there are 23,000 or so Marines every day that live west of the international dateline, and that puts them in a position, you know, complemented by the organic mobility that Marines bring with our organic aviation and naval surface platforms, you know, amphibious ships, it puts us sort of in a three-point stance, if you will, and able with limited I&W from positions already forward, you know, to get mm-hmm. in and occupy key maritime terrain in a way that, you know, first and foremost, we believe will be deterrent, but if necessary, mm-hmm. postured effectively to blunt, you know, any initial adversary action and set the conditions for joint force access and targeting going forward. You know, it would be intellectually dishonest to say it comes without risk, but it's the equivalent of, you know, saying that in a contested environment that if we have to project power as a nation, we're going to try to fight our way in and you know, smash the door open. We prefer to think of it as instead of, you know, having to bust down the door, as holding the door open from a position already
mm-hmm. in. That's a good metaphor. And are there specific examples that would make that more vivid? I mean, obviously, having to take off from San Diego is a disadvantage, but a lot of the critiques of traditional Marine Corps planning had said, you know, there's enormous vulnerability in our island bases in the Pacific. I mean, they'll be obliterated. So are you thinking of stand-in forces that are, you know, well forward of that are you know, more in place in Japan, in South Korea, in other places, just closer in?
That's right. So, thinking of them as, when we say expeditionary advanced bases, don't think traditional bases, you know, where we're pouring concrete and building family housing and things like that. I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. about bases in the sense of very temporary locations from which to operate, where we're not mm-hmm. building infrastructure so much, you know, as we're, you know, we're occupying, you know, locations for short periods of time to be capable of, you know, performing a function, whether that be, yep. you know, anti-surface fires against, you know, adversary shipping, or, again, forward arming refueling of aircraft, or, you know, projecting unmanned sensors, or any number of other, you know, capabilities, and not staying there long, moving often, yep. and staying small and agile. So that's what we're talking about, and that would be from mm-hmm. yes, from forward of the locations now where we have, you know, fixed bases.
So these stand-in forces would be moved to these locations, which would be you know, not permanent, but these are, it's not the same as the expeditionary mobile forces. It's something long, so between the two, longer, they'd be there earlier in the cycle and they'd be prepared to stay longer. Am I understanding that right?
No, we think it's essentially the same thing, that you know, stand-in forces, one of the things that stand-in forces do is they may choose to operate in accordance with this expeditionary advance base concept.
Okay.
But they're also the forces that are you know, that are doing, you know, exercises and you know, theater security cooperation and operating in just day-to-day competition alongside allies and partners, building interoperability, and then, you know, and present. During, you know, day-to-day or gray zone competition on a persistent basis, and then in a relevant posture such that if things do start to escalate, they're not far from being able to occupy, you know, key maritime terrain right. from which to do whatever it is that we need them to do. So, expeditionary advanced base operations is one of the operating concepts that the stand-in force may choose to employ depending on the situation.
Got it. So just to get a practical example, I don't know if you're prepared to answer this, but early in a period of rising tensions, say, with the PRC, it would be a question of whether the Marines, let's say, in partnership with Japanese self-defense forces, would choose to have, let's call them, stand-in forces on the Senkaku Islands. just to have them there, to move them there to be able to do all the things you talked about. Is that an example of what you, what this doctrine would suggest?
I'm trying to decide whether I should answer that. So I think, you know, what you've seen in recent bilateral exercises and multilateral exercises with, you know, the U.S. And our Japanese allies, you know, or other allies and partners in the region, I mean, you know, that is training to build interoperability and, you know, might also be considered rehearsals for things that, you know, someday we might have to execute.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed the, what is it called, Silent Dragon 21. Do I have the name of the exercise right? But there was a significant exercise that concluded.
A Resolute Dragon?
Resolute Dragon, exactly. So that was with the Japanese. And I haven't looked at the details, but it's on your website. I will look. But would that be an example that would help me understand what we're talking about here in terms of training, practicing, rehearsing, arguably?
I'll be honest with you, David. I'm not familiar with all the details of Resolute Dragon. I'd have to go back and dust that off. But I know that is one of many exercises that we've executed, you know, in the last, particularly the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force forward deployed there with the Japanese and others that are designed to ensure interoperability and to rehearse concepts of employment in the event that, you know, that we have to, you know, that things escalate and we've got to, you know, fight an adversary, you know, in that region. So, you know, I think that's...
Are there other partner forces that I should mention that are a special note beyond the Japanese?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the Australians are an absolutely essential partner there. And we've got, as you know, Marine forces now that are regularly based there in Darwin. That partnership is strengthening through, you know, obviously AUKUS has been featured recently. I think also you've seen, you know, an increased determination among some of our European allies to show presence in the region. You look at the recent deployment of the QE2, you know, with Marine F-35 jets on board and the amount of good work that they did over there. You know, obviously the Philippines is an important partner, an ally over there. So, you know, Korea, but I think certainly behind the Japanese, the Australians would be the next.
Okay. So this is helping flesh out the things of interest, but I want to make sure that I'm letting you, I mean, the things that you want to tell me that are ways of bringing the guidance conceptual framework that General Berger outlined 2 years ago to closer to reality. What else would be on your list?
Hey, David, you got Eric Austin here. Just a couple of comments, if I
may.
Agree with everything Ben said to this point. And before I get into my comments, I genuinely appreciate the opportunity because this is really important to us. We're doing a lot of work, and because of COVID and the way this rolled out, there's just, you know, we probably can't talk about it enough. So this is an opportunity we're pleased to have. First thing I want to say, it's sometimes missed, this is still the United States Marine Corps, and it's a people business. This is probably the biggest change in, I'd argue, maybe 70 years in the Marine Corps as an institution. But we're still Marines. We're still first to fight. We're still the nation's expeditionary force in readiness. And I just don't want that to get lost because we are very focused on the stand-in force on Indo-PACOM and on some of the new formations and that support it. But the entire Marine Corps is modernizing in a responsible fashion, and we're going to be better to do our job, certainly as a crisis response force as a result. So I just ask you to consider that where it makes sense. So if I were to describe the Commandant's tasking of Ben and myself and our boss, Lieutenant General Heckel, down here at Combat Development and Integration, it's to, one, you know, maintain our role as the nation's expeditionary force in readiness, and two, purpose build a stand-in force for Indo-PACOM that we've been describing so far in this conversation. Mm-hmm. Another point I just want to underpin that Ben made earlier is we are working exceptionally hard to have a solid analytic underpinning that really of war games, experimentation, and analysis that supports our strategic guidance from the NDS and the draft NDS and things going on across the joint force. I'm sure you've heard of the joint warfighting concept that reflects that and has the agility to make sure that we are properly nested as you know, contribute to the joint force and are leaning on the joint force in times. But I would say there's a frenzy of activities. The wargaming that's going on in the past 2 years is probably not, you know, the level of activity in that lane has probably not been the same since maybe in between World War One and World War Two. And then we're working through a flurry. We've had probably 30 detailed planning teams that have gotten together over the course of the last 2 years to really flush out some of the hard problem sets. And we've got a battle rhythm with the Commandant in an annual period that really is allowing us to be thoughtful and make decisions, make recommendations to inform that. And there have been some significant changes to the Marine Corps. So if you don't mind, I'll just rattle off a couple of them.
Please. Yes, sir.
So the first thing, the Marine Littoral Regiment is kind of the one of the new key formations that is an element of the stand-in force. We're planning to have three Marine Littoral Regiments, all based forward in Indo-PACOM as part of 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force. But most noteworthy, we're standing up in FY22, what's called the 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment, which will be the first one that we're going to stand up and we're going to experiment with and we're going to learn from. So that's an important element to you know, if the term I use is the train has left the station on that. We've made a...
And where will that 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment be based?
It's going to be based out of Hawaii.
Okay.
So it's formerly the 3rd Marine Regiment, and it's going to turn into will turn into the 3rd Marine Littoral Regiment here in the course of the
And the addition of littoral, what should that mean to people? That
it's
now was a regiment. It's now
a different formation, David. It's you know, it's a typical you know, Marine regiment, which Ben's got a lot more experience because he's an infantry officer could describe to you, but. This is a Marine Air Ground Task Force that's got a logistics element. It's got organic precision fires, both long range and some shorter range. It's got the ability to sense. It's got a littoral combat team, which is actually the core of which the core element is an infantry battalion reinforced with some more exquisite skill sets. So it is an entirely different formation, and it's designed to be purpose-built and standing, and also, if you let me, you know, go off just to expand on that a little bit. One of the things that we've been careful to, you know, we've carefully measured how we typically task organize for conflict, for operation, for you know, whatever the employment is and the operation is. What we recognize is that in a very fluid and dynamic scenario that is Indo-PACOM, we may not have that opportunity. So we are focused in these three formations, the three Marine Littoral Regiments, on having a purpose-built force that doesn't have to retool and change to transition from conflict, from competition to conflict and back. And we're also looking at some of the higher headquarters and mechanisms to allow that agility. Another thing, just we haven't talked about it, Ben mentioned earlier, I'll just segue briefly into this, is the fact that in our path, our, you know, what we think is a responsible path to modernization, we've leveraged our existing total obligation authority. So we're not asking for more money right now. We're basically, and you've touched on this, you know, we're divesting of capabilities and reinvesting it. One of the big things we've done is we're on a path to reduce end strength by 12,000 Marines. I think you know that. And part of that comes out of the Marine Littoral Regiment, which 3rd Marine Regiment, it's about 6,000 Marines. The resulting Marine Littoral Regiment will be about just over 2,000 Marines. So that's part of the efficiency.
The previous regiment was, didn't get the first number. The previous regiment was how many?
Yeah, so a normal Marine regiment, you know, you're talking, you know, 5 or 6 thousand.
Right.
And, you know, along the lines of being, you know, small, more mobile, more agile, a Marine Littoral regiment will be just over 2,000 Marines. So
okay.
Some enhanced capability.
That's fascinating.
But much smaller in terms of the number of people. But more heavier in terms of unmanned systems, long-range precision fires, the ability to sense and make sense of the environment, that kind of thing.
Good. That's very, very clear example of where we're going. I appreciate that.
One more point, and then I'll shut up here and answer questions. And we can talk about some specific capabilities, if that's helpful, about unmanned and loitering munitions you know, realizing the F-35 to its greater capability and sense and make sense. But I want you to know that we're very, very focused on logistics and sustainment because it's the pacing threat, and it's something that we got to get right, and it's really complex, particularly in a conflict scenario. So we are putting a lot of intellectual capital, experimentation, and analysis to figure that out, and I'll just leave it at that. Because a lot of people come back and say, how are you going to do this? Well, we're right. working through that right now. We've got some solutions, but we don't have it all figured out, and that's one of the things we know is we're, you know.
What? Give me some of the, sketch what that might look like and how it'd be different.
So we're talking about how do we pre-position supplies to provide us the opportunity to transition rapidly from competition to conflict. What do the distribution networks look like, and what are the platforms that we use to distribute, the supplies? How do we make the units that are part of the stand-in force or the crisis response force less reliant on energy and on supply and on so that we can focus on, you know, resupplying them ideally with, you know, lethality, which is the hard part. I don't know, Ben, any other examples?
I think, you know, part of this relates to, you know, and you might or might not have seen the Commandant's recently released talent management, you know, guidance. But part of this is, you know, to the point of the Marine Littoral Regiment, too, is how do we reduce demand? You know, so how do we make more multifunctional, Marines that, you know, whereas before maybe you had, you know, somebody who drives the truck, somebody who fixes the truck, you know, somebody who refuels the truck, et cetera. Now, you know, maybe that mechanic is the driver and he's also cross-trained, you know, to refuel the truck, to rig it. So it's a very simple example, but how do we, you know, reduce demand by reducing the number of humans that are postured forward?
So is there a metric that you have about the speed with which you can move from competition, as it were, to conflict? All sorts of scary numbers traditionally about just how long it would take to get the force in action.
I'll speak very vaguely for obvious reasons, but the discussion resides around, unambiguous and ambiguous warning periods, and we think that those are going to be minimal, which drives us to the necessary agility to transition back and forth between, a competition and a conflict posture. And certainly, given indications of warning, we're going to change our posture and make necessary adjustments. So I'll kind of leave it at that, if that's helpful, David.
I take it you can't be specific, but the idea is very quickly when you get early warning of one kind or another to move into this posture.
It is, and that's why we think, you know, having organic mobility is a key component of this stand-in force. You know, again, some of which, you know, we derive from marine aviation, but a really important part of it is our partnership, with the Navy as part of the Naval Service, and why we're watching very closely, you know, the trend lines as it comes to the, you know, the future amphibious fleet, and also why we're really invested in this future light amphibious warship program.
And part of it, David, is how we actually operate on a day-to-day basis. And I'll tell you, even though some of these improvements are still, a little bit on the horizon, we're working through the investments to get to realize some of the material capabilities. Again, it's a people business. And out there in 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, they're working through operations activities and investments. We call them OAIs. And they're engaged across the theater, and the concept being is through routine, engagement. You've already got, like Ben said, about a third of the force engaged in the theater. If you do have to make that rapid transition, it's how do you then reinforce that and take advantage of the opportunities that presents?
That's an accurate third? A third of the total U.S. Marine Corps force would be in the Indo-PACOM theater. On a regular basis, absolutely.
What I was talking about is kind of the operational construct for the Marine Littoral Regiment itself. About a third of the MLR is rotating through exercises, activities, engagements, and is forward at any given time, while, you know, the other two-thirds are either refit or training or whatever is relevant. And then we could obviously move Marines as necessary in time of crisis.
Yeah, but those MLRs, they'll operate, you know, within, underneath the higher headquarters and within the construct of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, and that's the majority of those, 23,000 Marines that are every day, like I said, are west of the international dateline, and they've got the same capabilities, in day-to-day, competition, working alongside allies and partners as they have in conflict. So, the idea is minimize the friction to transition.
So this is a super, that's very helpful set of ideas. Is there an unclassified short paper or congressional testimony or anything that you prepared that has these concepts fleshed out in the form of a formal briefing or presentation? I think I have everything I need from you, but if there's a backup document, it's useful just to kind of back check it. Is there anything like that?
So the thing that I think most immediately comes to mind is the Commandant published an article in Proceedings in November on Stand and Force concept.
I've got that. Okay. And as I say, we talked about it. And I gave him a little bit of lip about it, but that's I'll reread that.
Are you looking for something a little more meaty or detailed?
No, I think that's pretty meaty. It's just if there was anything that goes beyond that, I think your explication of this is couldn't be clearer. So I just have to go through it carefully. So I'm assuming that this is on the record, our conversation. That said, I always find it useful if somebody's writing an article about me just to send them the quotes I'm actually going to use. And so I'd be happy to send Major Benson, I think it is, whatever I'm going to use from the two of you in the column I write, just so you know it. In my experience, people only add clarity and strength to those comments. If I give them a chance to reflect on them, so I'll go ahead and do that on my own initiative.
No, thank you. It's certainly on the record, and but would appreciate the opportunity to take a look with anything you might use.
It's just as I say, in my interest to make sure I'm getting it right, and that it's the most forceful expression of what you want to say. Thank you so much for taking the time before Christmas. I'm going to do this. I got to talk with my editors about exactly when I want it to have some impact for people to read it, because I think it's really important. And so that's the one kind of gating issue, but I'll go over that with my colleagues. Thanks for taking the time. Merry Christmas.
Same to you, David. And I think you'll have a great conversation with Frank Donovan down at 2nd Marine Division. He's a pretty impressive.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. All right. Thanks very much.
All right, take care. Thanks.
Bye-bye.